Thanks for having me to speak at this event. In honor of the fact that this is a theoretical physics institute, I decided to have my first slide reflect the theoretical physics origins of much of what we do nowadays in biology. So it is the case that we owe much of the force of modern molecular biology to Max Delbruck and Erwin Schrödinger. It was Delbruck who was first attracted to genetics, looking for whether or not there might be biological versions of complementarity. In particular, that was his motivating, that was the motivating force for him. In the 1930s, he went to Caltech, where he hung out in the Thomas Hunt Morgan lab, and used to sit out on the curb with Calvin Bridges, watching girls at lunchtime, apparently, talking genetics. And it was as a result of Delbruck's initial speculations in this area that Schrödinger took an interest in the subject and wrote his little book called What is Life, that was catalytic for bringing so many physicists into molecular biology, not the least of which was Seymour Benzer, who started the area that I now work in. But for all of them, the attracting feature was, would there be some kind of biological complementarity associated with something apparently as strange as the gene? And when Delbruck realized, and when the Watson-Crick model of DNA was published in 1953, and it was clear that a gene, and Benzer did his equally groundbreaking work showing that the structure of the gene was a linear piece of DNA that could be divided up, but that had a certain large sort of large scale linear structure for what was the functional gene. Delbruck realized, no, there wasn't going to be anything at all funny about this. It was just alphabet soup, so let's leave the details to other people and go on, keep looking. But it was actually kind of a disappointment. And since then, biology has been very much imbued with the idea that we can figure it all out. It's just a bunch of putting together the pieces. The force of molecular biology has been identifying the pieces, determining how they interact with each other on a very local level, one-on-one, usually, and erecting from that schema for how the systems work. I was brought up in this tradition. It's what informs most of the research that you see going on today. And I want to show you some results from a variety of studies that we've done that have begun to make me question whether that's really a valid approach to the kind of problem that we're dealing with. So this has been our paradigm. Going back to the early days of fungal genetics, studying metabolism in Beadle and Tatum, and then carried on into bacterial metabolism, it began to be applied to other kinds of phenomena, particularly in the studies of phage morphogenesis by Edgar and Wood, and then really sort of blossomed into a major industry in the 1980s with the expansion of developmental genetics, and now also neurogenetics, in which phenotypes are analyzed by inducing mutations, usually large effect mutations, that block the phenotype in some fashion, identifying the components, identifying what is the apparent interaction among those components, which very often follows a kind of a pathway analogy. Sometimes it's literally a series of reactions of kinases and so on, other times a series of protein interactions, and so on. And from this, what we have gradually built up is a very Newtonian view of the way the cell works and the way the organism works, in which these things are arranged in their appropriate order. And we assume in a very Newtonian fashion that if we know the relationships among the elements, we know the rules that govern their behavior, we know the conditions at time zero, we can say what's going to happen next. In other words, we've begun to look at biology as if it is simply one very large Rube Goldberg. And if it is the case that it is one very large Rube Goldberg, then there is not any paradox here either. Okay, so Without telling you why I got into these studies, let me tell you the results of a series of studies that we've done that shed some light on this question. So it has, of course, been thought about and experimentally studied to some extent since the time of Darwin, trying to understand how selection alters phenotypes. And the great synthesis of the early 20th century, which was carried out in large measure by these three characters, though not exclusively, Ronald Fisher, Sewell Wright, and J.B.S. Haldane, variously put together notions of how Mendelian genetics could be reconciled with Darwinian selection, and in a kind of a simple summary of three of the major viewpoints that Sewell Wright assembled in one of his later publications, he summarized them as follows. The Fisherian model, the idea that you had many genetic variants of small effect that acted relatively independently, if not completely independently, so that in other words, their effects would add up as they were collected together by selection in these polygenic combinations. This very much fit with Fisher's background. He was a statistician. He was not really an experimentalist. He probably never touched an animal other than his little dog in his life. And therefore, it became actually maybe not essential, but certainly convenient to handle these elements as if they were independent in their activity. Sewell Wright, on the other hand, had very much of a biologist's background. He was trained in the very first genetics lab in the United States, which was at Harvard, run by William Castle at the turn of the 20th century, where they studied mammalian coat color genetics in particular. That was Sewell Wright's thesis project. And for any of you who are at all familiar with mammalian coat color genetics, there is no knottier problem than the interactions among genes to produce the various colors, patterns, and so on of mammalian coat colors. Any of you who have a Siamese cat or an animal that has sort of a hair shaft where you can see the different patterns along the shaft, you can imagine. So his notion was much more of a gene interactive notion. But there still were a lot of elements, and they were not necessarily of large effect, but that they acted very much less independently than in Fisher's model. And eventually, as he even described it himself, it was more of a kind of a network notion of the combinations of alleles. And then J.B.S. Haldane, perhaps reflecting, if not his training, at least his personality, thought that, of course, each gene would have an enormous effect, as he was a rather egotistical individual, and that what would occur would be large-scale changes in individual genes, which would have the appropriate phenotypic effects through development. And one of the difficulties in the ensuing years has been the barriers to testing any of these ideas at the level of what are the actual genes that do change during selection, and how can one track them, and how can one understand what they're actually doing. Much has been done at a statistical level, looking at sort of large-scale effects of selection and back crosses and F1 and F2 matings and so on. But until recently, it was extremely difficult, if not impossible, to know what was actually going on underneath the surface with the genes themselves. I will describe you three experiments that we've been involved in, which have tried to do that, at least in a quick and dirty way, because we realized that with the advent of whole genome information and microarray technology, it would be possible to assay gene expression changes after selection, which, while not the same as telling you exactly which genes are different alleles from each other, some of the time it will, others of the time it'll tell you things that are perhaps consequences of that, it gives you some insight into the molecular changes underlying phenotypic change. And then one can even begin to test some of the differences by looking at effects of mutations independently derived in some of the same genes. And I will describe to you three different time courses of selection and some of the interesting differences that you find as you look over time and some of the characteristics that they have in common. First example is aggression in fruit flies, which was studied in my lab by one Hermann Dierich when he was a postdoc in the lab. It's been known for many years that fruit flies in the laboratory are rather docile. Fruit flies in the wild are not very docile. They can be quite aggressive. You bring them into the laboratory, they are aggressive for at least a few generations, and then they lose it. But on the other hand, you can get it back relatively easily by selecting for it. Yeah. Oh, we'll get there. We'll get there. Indeed. But you'll know before too long what I think about that. We're going there. Because part of my aside about the technical difficulties of following what the genes do meant that it was, in a sense, almost impossible to distinguish among them until relatively recently. There were statistical results that would suggest that the large gene effects are very rare in initial stages of these, but it was otherwise controversial based on those kinds of very indirect experiments as to what might be going on. So aggression is a phenotype that flies have in the wild. They don't have it in the lab. It's relatively easy to get it back in the lab. Herman did that. He selected after 11 generations. He could get flies that would fight a lot. I would show you a little movie of this, but really it's just, pardon me? He would set up a whole sort of arena where he'd have little food patches like that, because males will fight over a food patch, because that's where they pick up chicks. And he would then wait and look to see if if two males are fighting consistently. He would come in through a little porthole with a little aspirator. He would pluck them out and save them. And those would be the males who he would mate to make a more aggressive strain in the next generation. And then he would eliminate all the fighting males and pick some of the males that were left and use them to form the non-selected or the quasi-anti-selected ones, the neutral ones, as he called them. So you could get a lot of aggression after 11 generations, a bit more after 21. It's relatively specific for aggression. This is just showing the intensity of what they do. They're not better at courtship. They're not better at mating. They're relatively specific for aggression. They're not big bruisers and so on. So you take the heads of the flies, which are mostly brain. You grind them up and extract RNA from it. You run genome expression experiment between the aggressives versus the non-aggressives. You get a whole bunch of genes that are different. In all of these experiments, you always find a whole bunch of genes that are different. In this case, they're genes most of which only have code numbers, meaning that they've been identified as putative genes, even have transcripts, but not really known what they do. Of the ones that are known, there are some that have obvious neuronal relevance, but not very many. They're all over the map in terms of what they do, and that's always what you find in these experiments. But I want to bring a couple of things to your attention. First is that none of the changes in expression are very big. None of these are bigger than 2.5-fold. They average about 1.5 to 2-fold differences. So they're all pretty subtle. They're Fisherian in the sense of being small effects. Some of these he was able to show by testing individual mutants actually do affect aggression on their own, but that's not the point of my talk today, so I'm not going to go into that very much. Some of these may well not be at all relevant to the selected phenotype. They may be polymorphisms that were already in the strains, that were hitchhiking along with them, and so on. We don't know the answer to that. He sort of took a compromise between taking totally wild flies, where he knew there'd be lots of polymorphism, much of which would be spurious for this, and flies that were highly inbred. So what he did was to take a bunch of the standard wild-type fly strain, known as Canton-S, which he got from 6 different laboratories where it had been separated for years. And we already know from both behavioral experiments and from molecular experiments that that's enough to make them be different strains. He mixed them all together, and that was his starting population. But that was the background that he wanted to have also, so he could go eventually to a uniform background to test it. Well, yeah, but so long ago that it's irrelevant. In other words, when you make a fly line isogenic, it's good for about 2 months. And these are lines that have been separated. These are lines that have been in the laboratory for about 40 years and separated from each other for at least 10, which means they're different. And we know that from lots and lots of experiments. Okay, so here's the first observation. These are the genes that have been known up till now from standard mutant studies. See, more Benzer kind of study. You isolate a mutant, usually a fairly large effect one, you see if it affects your phenotype. These are the genes known to affect aggression in fruit flies. Zero overlap with any of the ones that we find as being different in our strain. And Herman looked even more concernedly for anything related to serotonin, which, according to Ed Kravitz and many others, is the holy grail for aggression, and not a single one of the genes related to serotonin synthesis, transport, receptor, or anything else that he could think of is varying between these strains. So to a first approximation, this has a bit of a Fisherian flavor to it. Oh, in addition, he also found that the behavior in these strains appears to be primarily as if the variants are additive in their effects. And that's based on F1, F2 crosses, and also trying to make combinations between mutants identified in some of these genes. So it looks as though you've got a fair number of small effect mutations naturally occurring in it, which are being grouped together by means of a selection, which do not have appreciable interactions between each other. Okay, that's short-term selection. Now I'll show you an example of medium-term selection, which is not behavioral, and it's not the same phenotype. I haven't been able to do this all for the same one yet, but it makes an analogous set of points. It's a developmental phenotype studied by my friend Ken Weber, who's in the University of Maine. It's where he simply selected for variation in wing morphology, looking at the ratio between this parameter and this parameter, and selecting for ones where the wings are long and thin versus short and squat. He gets distinct divergence. After an initial 25 generations, he got a fairly good divergence. Then he mixed them all together. Mixed after 20. He mixed them all together, let them interbreed randomly for 34 generations. And the point here was to try to purify the relevant genes, to cross away the crap that was being carried along with it and try to get down to the more relevant natural variations. You know, it's like when you re-extract something in your organic chemistry lab. Then he re-selected parallel four lines of the high parameter, four lines of the low ratio parameter for another 25 generations. And the reason that this is expected to be different from a 20 generation selection is that it is generally hypothesized, because it's not shown, but it's generally hypothesized that after about 20 generations, you can start selecting for newly arising mutations in the population, that it takes at least that long before something new could arise and begin to be selected for. So, in this case, we took the wing disc, which is a more, even better enrichment of a tissue, found a bunch of genes that are different. Here's what they are. Again, most of them are genes where the function is not very well known. Those for which it is known are not exactly very specific genes for wing development. There's an actin gene, there's a cell death gene, a ribosomal gene. One difference now is that you're seeing these are larger effect expression differences. We're now getting up above twofold. We're getting up to three and fourfold differences between them. And in addition, here now is the comparison with the known genes affecting wing development in the fly, of which there are no fewer than 214. It's probably the longest studied phenotype in the history of fly genetics, going all the way back to the very first mutants in the Morgan lab. Not a single one overlaps with any of the genes that we see changing in our experiment. So now you can say, well, at least it's not a sampling problem with respect to the mutagenesis. You could say that our expression differences are a poor assay for the polymorphisms. And indeed, they're not a very complete assay. But we also know, if only from these mutants, that many mutants in the fly simply are expression level differences. Hypomorphs are very often mutants that are simply expressing the same transcript at a lower level, so on and so on. So it's definitely not a rarity. Finally, there is some evidence from Ken's studies for interactions between some of these loci, suggesting that maybe when you select for a somewhat longer period of time, you begin to get more of a Ripien flavor to it, where again, you still have a fair number of loci contributing, but now they begin to intertwine a bit more. Yeah. Ah, it's not a terribly detailed notion of what an interaction is. It just means that statistically, that the combination gives you something that is different from the predicted effect of adding the two individual effects by themselves. Yes, in the phenotype. It's entirely based on the phenotype. It's not, this doesn't come from the gene expression data. This comes from studies that he's done of looking at recombination of these along these chromosomes. That's another potential thing that we're missing, that we're only assaying at a given time. We're not seeing it all the way through its own time course. No, our assay is admittedly limited in the sense that it's not comprehensive with respect to the kinds of genetic variants or to the time course or the tissue in which they're being done. It's a small slice in time. However, one would still expect to see, if it was relevant, one would still expect to see it some of the time. Given that these expression level different mutants are not rare, and given that this tissue in particular, which is the third larval stage wing precursor cells, are ones where a very large number of those genes that affect wing development are expressed at that time. So it's not an inappropriate time to be looking, even though it isn't comprehensive. No. Okay, we're going to get there too. That's a major point we're getting to.
When you say it doesn't affect anyone, that doesn't say that. In other words, those who could deal with it could affect them. When you say it doesn't affect, you mean it's not in, you didn't find any of the reasons from 216 or whatever it was, but the mutations you identified that are different could affect the expression of those.
No, it's not apparently affecting any of them because we would have assayed them. That is, we would have, if they were different in their expression level in the wing disc, at that time, we would have seen it. So it suggests that it's not affecting them by changing their expression level dramatically. It could be changing their expression level highly locally. Okay, if three cells in the disc are changing, we're not going to pick that up either. So, okay. We can only distinguish differences in the level of expression. We can't distinguish spatial differences or sequence differences. No, we're not picking up sequence differences unless they're dramatically different. A sequence difference can show up as an expression difference if the binding in the hybridization is affected. So it can be, but not necessarily. All right, here's the third case, long-term. And I do mean long-term, because this is actually one of the original Drosophila behavioral selection experiments, begun in the late 1950s by one Jerry Hirsch when he was at Columbia and later at the University of Illinois, a series of experiments he carried out in order to demonstrate that there were genetic influences on behavior, which in the 1950s was a notion considered to be completely impossible and not even worth considering because of the reign of behaviorism and Skinnerian thought. So he devised this geotaxis assay in which he would test the fly's response to gravity by putting it through this choice maze made up of little glass tubes and rubber connectors where the flies go in this side. There's a big light source here, and flies are phototactic, so they'll try to go towards the light. But to get there, they constantly have to be turning up and down to be able to make progress. And so their relative preference for up or down will be revealed. Most fly populations will tend to go through around the middle. But he selected for the extremes at either end and eventually was able to make strains that had a distinct preference for being negatively or positively geotactic after an initial, in this case, 50 generations of selection. And then he kept it going for decades. He would haul them out every year to teach his undergraduate genetics course and have the students reselect them. And you'd see that each year they would relax a little bit and then come back. And even if they let them go for several years, they'd still come back. Or even if they accidentally mixed them up, they'd still come back relatively quickly. And then in around the early 80s, the line stabilized so that they would no longer relax back and then maintain the phenotype. And in the year 2000, when we called him up and he said, yes, I still have the flies right here on my desk. He was in retirement, but he still kept these flies. We tried them out in our own little plastic maze, and sure enough, this is the upgoing line, perfect phenotype, almost all the way through to the end, and the low ones also were going low. So we assayed these for their gene expression differences. It just shows the phenotype. Found a whole bunch of genes that were different. There were genes affecting a whole bunch of different things, a few of them in the nervous system, some affecting circadian rhythms. This is not a behavior that is very much of a circadian rhythmic behavior. We were able to show that the expression differences could be actually quite large in some of these. These are 4- and 5-fold differences. Some of them were 8- and 9- and 10-fold differences as well. Some of them we could show individual differences that were rather large and that would act independently. Mutations in this neuropeptide that's involved in rhythms expressed in this group of cells in the brain would accurately reproduce the behavior, and this is a fairly large expression difference. Another circadian rhythm gene, a light receptor, God knows why, this is not a light, it's a phototactic behavior, but this is not involved in phototaxis. Nonetheless, this too was a large expression difference, which independently was able to give you the same sort of behavior. And then here's an enormously pleiotropic gene, one of the nuclear importin proteins involved in shuttling things into the nucleus. It's expressed in every cell in the nervous system, lethal when you knock it out. But when you look at a heterozygous mutant, it gives you a very dramatic effect on this behavior in the same direction as the selected line. A Haldanian kind of a flavor to it, where you have larger effect both in terms of expression and an individual gene contribution after a long-term kind of selection. Finally, here's the set of genes known from a fairly extensive mutagenesis done for this behavior, and as you've come to expect now, none of these are among the genes that were changed in our selection experiment. Finally, we asked the question, because this had a long history, we could ask what was the development of gene interactions, of epistatic interactions, as they're known, through the course of this experiment. So the experiment began in 1958. By the time they published their first analysis of it, after they had gone through probably, the analysis was done on generations around 30 and 40, they found that by separating chromosomes and making combinations of them, it looked as if you had additive effects. When they did the same analysis several years later, they began to see non-additivity in them. Finally, when the strains became stabilized, they had increasing non-additivity. And in our own tests of them more recently, I'll show you exactly how it comes out. This is the... Sure. Well, we are sure. We all have, all of us have gravity sensation, and in vertebrates, we have these little tiny calcium precipitate particles in our inner ear, which brush against the little hair cells, which are innervated and which give you your vestibular sort of response to things. Is that an accurate description of what goes on? I don't know much about vertebrates. In insects, they have postural ways of detecting it that have to do with sort of sensors at the joints and so on. Even some individual cells, like paramecium, actually have ability to sense gravity. In their case, it has to do with picking out differences in the density of the medium. That depends on what's adaptive for you. So the fly's reflex-like response is that if you startle it, it's going to go away from gravity. And that's what Chip Quinn used to call the shaking the trash can effect, that they're going to try to get away. It usually corresponds to also being the direction of light, which they're also responsive to. But if you do the experiment in the dark, they'll still tend to want to go up as an escape. So in these kinds of insects, it seems to be related to an escape response. You're going against their normal predilection. It's also harder to get them to do that. It's a harder thing to find, harder to find genetic combinations which will produce that. And to a certain extent, they're not as healthy flies. Okay, this is the nature of the way Hirsch did his tests of chromosome interactions, which we recapitulated, where you take the strain, the two different strains, you isolate individual chromosomes onto an otherwise neutral background, which is our Campanesque standard wild-type background. You can look at each chromosome as an independent, or you can put them together in combinations. And here's what you find. This is the geotactic score. You can do a titration of the behavior with different combinations of these chromosomes, but the crossover point isn't where it's supposed to be. So that where this crosses from being high to low is not where the chromosomes go from being high to low, as you can see here. And in particular, the best example of a nonlinear interaction is if you take this strain that has the second low chromosome, and this strain that has the first low chromosome, neither of which gives a low score. This one, in fact, is slightly high. You put the two of them together, and you get almost the full phenotype of the low selective strain. So this is a very strong non-additive interaction. So, to a first approximation, there is some reason for thinking that maybe all three of these models are correct, but that they apply at different stages of the process. And you can even imagine how this might be, that initially, you're not going to have much chance to weave extensive interactions. You grab what's there, it's usually fairly subtle, and you put it together to get an effect out of it. If you've gone for a bit longer, you have more of a chance to select for the recombination in chromosomes to put things together and the more intricate sort of alteration of a network. And then if that goes on for a long enough time, you can actually have a chance to accrue a larger effect mutation and actually have it be selected for. And I have more to say about this at the end. But in the meantime, this would also argue this idea that you get a gradual increase in the gene interactions, plus this would argue that there are going to be distinct differences in the structure of the transcriptional networks in these strains as time goes on. So I borrowed a mode of analysis developed by Steve Horvath at UCLA, which sort of looks in a formal way expression networks in animals, in organisms, by simply looking at those genes that have similar patterns of expression, and basically what you do is a cross correlation, every gene in the genome versus every other gene in the genome, which ones tend to correlate with each other, and then beyond that, you ask which sets of them tend to have overlapping patterns, as if they're being co-regulated and as if they're part of a similar sort of network. And you can sort of express this in a dendrogram where the length of the line along this axis is a sense, in a sense, a measure of how differentiated that cluster is from other clusters. So you look at this for these three strains, for these three experiments, and you don't find any great difference between the short and medium term, but you do see a fairly significant difference for the long-term one, suggesting that indeed these are far more differentiated clusters, hierarchically differentiated, as a matter of fact, is the way that their modeling sort of comes out in expressing these things. What that means at this point, we don't know, nor do we know in detail what any of these clusters mean. It's just a formalistic way of characterizing the idea that there clearly are differences in the overall structure of interactions in the genome as you go through these longer term selections in this instance. That's one of the points that I'm going to be leading up to. But that's exactly right. That seems to be the case of what's going on. Now let's get to the other question that kept coming up along the way in this. Why are the genes so different that we find versus ones that you find in mutant genes? One possibility is that we're missing them, but the other possibility is that these networks are far more wide ranging than we had previously thought, and then was revealed by the classic mutant isolation interaction studies that have been so prevalent in modern day genetics. So we looked at this problem in a different fashion, one which actually tries to measure interactions between identified genes in known backgrounds to see to what extent do you really have a kind of a wide-ranging network. So the first experiment of this sort was done by Bruno van Swinderen in the lab, where we picked a very simple phenotype. There was a temperature-sensitive mutation in syntaxin in flies, part of the secretion machinery that's in nerves that involves vesicle release. When you put these flies at high temperature, they fall over. And if they're a uniform background, you get a fairly characteristic quantitative time course of it. Bruno then did the classic sort of isolate suppressors and enhancers of this, looking for the syntaxin effect works dominantly in a heterozygote, is passing out at high temperature. He would then pick up new mutations in other genes that also act dominantly in heterozygotes to shift the curve to the left or right, and did this all using the same kind of insertion mutant on a similar background so that it was all well healed. Found a whole bunch of genes, none of which had anything to do with this machinery, as you've come to expect now, and most of which didn't even have anything to do with what we thought would be relevant to it. So we said, okay, well, maybe these are just willy-nilly affecting this phenotype. Is there any evidence that they function as a kind of a network? So the way that we decided to test that idea is in the following sense, sort of a classic assay borrowed from quantitative genetics, where you make now a double heterozygote on an otherwise normal background. These flies are normal for syntaxin, but they're heterozygous for two of the genes. And here you do a specific test of a prediction of what the effect of adding them together should be versus what you observe. And the way you do this is basically you do a matrix of crosses among all of the genes, produce all the double heterozygotes. For each individual gene, you calculate what is its average effect across this matrix. And then you get the predicted value by putting together two genes' average effects. And you ask, does it differ from what you observe? And if it's significantly different, then you can conclude that it's a non-additive effect. If it's a synergistic sort of effect, then that's evidence, at least to a certain extent, that they may well be functioning as part of a network. He then did the same experiment all over again all the pairs of double heterozygotes in the presence of the syntaxin mutation, see what it would look like when you put them together. All right, out of this kind of experiment, this is for 8 of them, you can draw a formal sort of connectivity diagram based on whether or not they have a non-additive interaction with each other, and positive and negative just simply means that they shift the curve to the left or to the right. So here's an example of a gene that interacts with many, here's one that interacts with fewer of them, and so on. This is on the wild type background. This is just the double heterozygotes of the suppressor. Now you add back in the syntaxin mutation, and things start to change. You lose all these yellow dotted ones, now lose their the interactions now become predictable, they now become additive. In the case of the red lines here, they've shifted polarity, and only in the case of these green lines are they the same kind of interactions that they used to be. But much more obviously is the number of new interactions that arise. This is changing one allele in the background as a heterozygote. So in other words, the functional relationships among these genes is wholesale different after changing one allele in the background. This is like a controlled experiment in genetic background, as opposed to what happens in general when you have these sort of nondescript and unknowable background effects on a mutation. Here we're making a distinct known change in it and showing that it has a fairly dramatic effect on what we infer to be the network relationships among these genes. We did it with the other 8 and we found the same thing. So there's a plasticity, a malleability to these gene networks that one might not have expected from doing the classic kind of mutant analysis experiment where you do a large effect mutation, you add up the effects of your large mutations, and you see what you think your pathway looks like. That's not what we're doing here. What we're doing here is a subtler kind of manipulation that takes the system not as far from its normal operating range. So, having done all of these things, Herman, the guy who studied aggression, the very non-aggressive guy who studied aggression, came into the lab one morning and said, "All right, if everything affects everything else, let's test it." So we sat down and we planned an experiment in which we were going to pick 8 mutations affecting a range of biochemical functions, most of which not expected to affect any of the phenotypes we're going to look at, and see, can you affect any phenotype from anywhere in the genome? How wide-ranging are these networks? So we called this a matrix experiment. So we pick 8 mutations, all the same kind of insertion mutant, all on the same background. We biased it that they would all have something to do with the nervous system, so because we would look at behavior, but only one of them was known to affect one of the behaviors we were going to study. And these are the genes, a transcription factor, Nalioc, known to be a long-term memory mutant in flies, but otherwise, based on their studies, normal, not known to affect our behaviors. This is one of the genes involved in the vesicle secretion apparatus, like syntaxin. This is Seymour Benzer's first aging mutant that lives 3 times longer than normal flies. Another transcription factor, not known at all to be related to behavior. The inositol triphosphate receptor, a very ubiquitous gene affecting internal calcium stores in cells. This is our geotaxis gene, that's the nuclear importing gene, so we stuck this in as an internal control. This is a serine threonine kinase involved in neurosensory cell development. And this is an embryonic RAS pathway interacting gene. Some of these are lethal as homozygotes, some of them are mild, but in all cases we're testing them as heterozygotes, so we're not knocking anything out, ever. And these are the behaviors that we easily assay quantitatively in the lab. This is what you get. You get 28 different double heterozygous combinations. This gives you a taste of it. Not everything affects everything, but a hell of a lot of things affect a hell of a lot of things. So eventually you can fill in most of the matrix. It's usually, in general, it's not one gene doing everything. If you look for the observed versus expected effects, as in the syntaxin study that I showed you, mostly these interactions are due to the specific combination of the 2 genes, not to any one primarily acting dominantly in it. So this notion of particular combinations tweaking this system in a way to give you an outcome is the same thing that we see previously. All right, then we wanted to ask the following question. Let's say these are very wide-ranging networks. Let's say you can affect phenotypes from a very wide range of places in the genome. When you are doing so, are you working through the core set of genes that you think should be governing it and that come out of the standard mutant studies of what would be the core set of genes doing that? So we ran gene expression microarrays on this entire set of them, which we could only afford to do by teaming up with my friend in England, Bambos Kiriakou, who got access to the Cambridge facility where they would do it for a song. And we picked circadian rhythms as our first one to look at, because circadian rhythms is the best worked out mechanism for which genes are at the real core of it. And of all of our genotypes, we had a couple that were short rhythm and several that were long rhythm. These don't seem like giant differences in periodicity, but for this behavior, they are quite large differences. Circadian rhythm period is one of the tightest, lowest variance behaviors on the globe. So they're getting this much of a deviation is even difficult to do by selection. So you take the short ones together versus the long ones. You get very different transcriptional networks out of them. This is a correlation matrix of the top 1,500 genes in terms of which ones are correlated with each other. Very different from the long matrix, but it's even more different than that, because if you index the long genes in the same way as the short genes, you find that that's actually, this is the appropriate comparison, is that matrix versus that matrix. That tells you that just by having a couple of different pairs of heterozygous mutations in a strain, you are dramatically changing the transcriptional network in it. You're not knocking anything out. You've only changed two alleles, and you've only done it at maximum 50% of its normal level of activity. You get a very major change in the transcriptional network of it. Yes? Yes, that's right. Okay, so here's the circadian rhythm core mechanism from known very well from the work of my former. It's a suggestion that it's going to at some level have something to do with connectivity without telling you directly what that connectivity is. But presumably it's going to be related to some degree of connectivity in the system. Well, that's not what Horvath, Deschwin, and more recently Eric Schatt have actually found when they've done studies using that analysis initially and then actually going into the system to ask what is going on. They actually find that if you look now among genes where you know their relationships and so on, that you can demonstrate that you're getting differences in what appears to be sort of the flow through a network. So it's not completely separate from it. The underlying network that makes it happen, which I'm not mapping and I'm not showing you. It's very difficult to draw it from that, but it's clearly going to be a function of it. So that, and that's all we're getting at this stage. It is the case that sometimes you get differences that don't involve, well, it's certainly the case in these networks that you can get differences in connectivity that don't correlate with differences in expression level. That's also possible in these instances. Mm-hmm. Oh. No, that's right. That's right. No, and I'm not claiming. That's right. And I'm not claiming that this is going to draw you the network. It's just another observation to tell you, in a sense, how different is the effect on the overall system of this relatively subtle genetic manipulation. That's the point. So here's the core gene, the core set of genes that are the circadian clock. And what they consist of primarily are the first two that were found, a gene called period and timeless, which are transcribed in the nucleus under the control of two transcription factors called clock and cycle. Their products are translated with the time delay in the cytoplasm. They associate with each other. They undergo various states of phosphorylation, transported back into the nucleus, whereupon they shut down their own transcription. And it is the time, it's the fact that it's a shutting down of their own transcription with time delays based on when they're translated and when they're transported back into the nucleus that gives you the cyclical behavior over a 24-hour period of the clock. And then the other relevant genes are these kinases and phosphatases that modify. Are any of these changed in it? The answer, of course, you know by now, is no. None of those are. The only gene in our entire matrix that is at all related to rhythms that was changed is this cryptochrome gene, which in the fruit fly is not part of the core clock, but part of the light entrainment system, whereby the clock is entrained to the day-night cycle. But we could test it independently to see if by some chance it was altering it. The correlation that we had seen is that our short strains have lower levels of expression of cryptochrome than the longer strains. And there's a fairly good correlation across all of our genotypes for cryptochrome levels. But if you look at a cryptochrome mutant and mutant heterozygote, you get, in fact, the opposite, if anything. The heterozygote gives you a shorter period than the homozygote. So it's not, does not account for the effects that we're seeing, suggesting that the alterations that we're getting in the period are acting somehow through other sets of genes than the core clock. We did the same thing with respect to sleep, which we have been studying in our lab and which others have been studying, for which we now know a reasonable number of genes that are involved in it, looking at the long sleepers versus the short sleepers. These are the genes that we know so far are affected in it. None of these seem to correlate with our selected, with our differences among any of these strains. We then asked the question, using again another one of these statistical methods developed by Steve Horvath, whether perhaps these genes themselves are not altered, but maybe they show some sort of close correlation with other genes in these strains that are altered. And there, at least, we could find several of them that were perhaps one step removed, but showed some degree of effect correlating with whether they were long or short sleepers. So again, it seems as though it may be that they're operating through these genes, we're not quite sure, but it's in no sense that it's not an obvious correlation, not an obvious connection between the genetic changes that we introduce and the phenotypic changes that come out the other end.
Well, can you put that,
in this case?
Yeah.
These are ones where mutants in any of, well, these are two mutants affecting the dopaminergic system, mm-hmm. which has very major effects on regulating sleep and arousal in flies. This is separate from the circadian aspect. This is sort of affecting more the homeostatic aspect of sleep. This is a ligand part of the EGFR pathway, which also we've shown has very major effects on regulating sleep and arousal in the fly. Yeah. It's not a gene that cycles. Cryptochrome is not a cycling gene. Okay, so do we... They don't, though, cryptochrome itself is not regulated by those genes. It participates in the light entrainment part of the cycle, but it does not, it is not part of the oscillator. In mammals it is, but not in fruit flies. Apparently not. No, apparently its regulation is independent of their regulation. Okay, so all of these results that I've told you, without my being able to give you a cogent explanation for all of them at least contribute to the notion that there are very that the gene networks are very wide-ranging in terms of where you can affect phenotypes from. The selection experiments argue for this, the non-overlap with known mutants, and the gene interaction experiments that I described to you in terms of defined sets of interactions that give you that. So one of the suggestions that you get from this is that, and this is something that networks certainly are capable of showing, is that you can have small effects appropriately connected to give you large changes in the output of the system. And it suggests that gene networks may be quite responsive to changes, even mild ones, that occur very broadly in the system. This is a very different sort of picture than the way we have generally viewed things in this sort of current day molecular biology pathway paradigm, where things are thought to operate, if not completely in an insulated fashion, at least in a narrow enough window that you can have you can think you know what it's going to do under a given set of circumstances. But I don't think that that's a good representation for this. I think that it's an inappropriate paradigm. And let me talk about it. So it is, in a sense, a kind of a control theory, or in Lee Hood's parlance of systems biology, the car engine sort of metaphor, that you have a system that is basically, as I said at the very outset, as if it were a large Rube Goldberg, and you just have to know the way all the parts interact with each other, and when you make manipulations to them, the system will adjust appropriately, but in essentially a predictable way. And that one could model this in that sort of fashion with something like a sort of a control theory approach to it. But I think that when you get to something that's that big and that's that variable, you might be able to model it, but it would not necessarily reflect the underlying structure. And that's what I believe is the problem here, is that I don't believe that this is the underlying structure for the kind of system we're looking at. Instead, I think it has more of the following character. That for any given phenotype, it will have the following sort of topography. That there will be a large, wide-ranging network of genes that are capable of influencing that phenotype. When you make a change in one of them, it distorts. It distorts, perhaps, you know, not uniformly, but it distorts certainly more broadly than we operate, assuming, when we think that we can make a knockout of a gene and be able to put together the effects of many different knockouts and assume that that adds up to the functioning of the system. And depending where you make the alteration, you will distort it in different directions. So the nature of these kinds of systems, which I think is as true of the brain as it is of any of these other biological networks, is that they are an interesting compromise between elements acting totally independently of each other and elements being completely uniformly interconnected to each other. They're heterogeneous sets. They're interestingly heterogeneous sets where the elements are heterogeneous in identity and in their connectivity. And part of the point here is that, well, I'm going to get back to this. I think my pot shots at Jim Watson later. There are some implications of this. One of the implications of it is exactly the thing that Simon brought up earlier. The idea that how can you get large-scale genetic changes without the system crashing? And according to, this is my pot shot of Sean Carroll. So according to the current view in Evo-Devo, what we look at when we look at species differences are we find regulatory differences between genes, and we infer that these are the regulatory differences that gave rise to these relatively large pattern changes that we see across evolution, which is certainly what is there no question about that's what is there. It's another question about whether it got there directly. Do these things just arrive and work? And can they do so without the system crashing? Here's an example. Very nice experiment from Bill McGinnis's lab showing that if you take the UBX gene from the one of the Hox genes from Artemia and put it into a fly embryo, you can get Artemia-like multiple specifications of limbs, but it's lethal to the embryo, for example. So you can see how it can do it, but you can't see how it can do it and work in an adaptive fashion. How could you get there? Maybe this is how you get there, just as Simon was saying. And I'm unaware that Waddington had proposed it. I have to have you tell me the reference for that. But the notion that indeed, what goes on is you're warping the network. As you select, you're creating an environment in which you're pushing and pulling on this thing, so that now if a large effect mutation arises, it's not distorting the system, it's reinforcing it. And by reinforcing it, it makes it that it will be able to be carried along. In terms of genetic inheritance, it's easier to carry along because it's a single large effect locus rather than 25 that you have to inherit every time to be able to maintain the phenotype. And it allows you an opportunity to whittle away at it so that it is either less deleterious or more specific in its action or whatever. So basically, you get the same kind of warping as a result of these selections as you do with the best. Finally, getting back to how these systems function, the degree to which there is a fundamentally indeterminate element to the way these systems function, non-Newtonian in that sense, is the idea that these are heterogeneous systems. They have lots of components to them, but the components are not all identical, and they're not all absolutely different from each other either. They associate, they cluster, their relationships are flexible. The systems are highly degenerate. That's what all of the data that I've shown argue for, is that they're highly degenerate systems. There are multiple solutions to the problem. And if you have multiple solutions to the problem, it means that you're not going to be able to model it as one large Rube Goldberg, because it's not going to work through the same relationships in the same sets of components. And finally, that what you have then is this notion of combinatorial relationships among things, which represent a potential repertoire. And it's out of that repertoire that the appropriate stimuli and past history and inherited capabilities will allow some combination of them to emerge at a given time that is adaptive for the organism. And maybe it's several of them at the same time in varying proportions. And it's going to vary from individual to individual. It's going to vary in the same individual from one time to the next. When you knock out a system and it doesn't cause the whole thing to crash, presumably it's because you have these other ones that are there. And they weren't selected to be backups. They're not redundant in that sense. They're not identical. They're degenerate because the system, if it doesn't have this degree of degenerate leeway, then it's not going to be able to evolve. To evolve, you have to have that kind of flexibility. This is the flaw that the intelligent design people have correctly seized upon that's wrong with the molecular paradigm. They say, it all fits together too well. How could you have evolved it? And the answer is, it doesn't fit together quite as well as it looks. It's not just that exclusive. It is intrinsically messier than that on a day-to-day functional basis. That's why it could evolve. That's how it can change. That's how it can sustain a great many insults without crashing, i.e. be robust. And it's something that we don't have a good way of characterizing at the moment. It's something that requires, I think, a theoretical approach. And one which, although I can describe it metaphorically, I'm not somebody who could do that kind of theoretical approach. So what is it that would be in common, if not the specific identified components? Maybe it's that you have classes of them, and you need the right relationships among those classes. And if it's a system which can be which then will give an appropriate output when you get the right combination of elements from among a grab bag of them, and you just need to have the right relationship. What's evidence for this? Well, what's evidence for this is the evolution of the actual circadian clock itself. This is in a narrower molecular sense. I've described to you the fly clock. The mouse clock and the human clock are virtually identical with the substitution of cryptochrome in the mammal for timeless in the fly. The sequences are homologous. You can see that it's the same genes that have just changed a little bit over time. You go to Neurospora, the little fungus, and you find very limited sequence homology, only for a couple of the components, very distantly so. But if you look at the relationship among the elements in the system, it is the same mechanism. You now go to cyanobacteria, the oldest organism that's still alive on the Earth. It was probably the dominant mode of life on the Earth for 2 billion years that gave us our oxygen, that made us an oxidizing atmosphere. They've had a circadian rhythm probably all along. Zero sequence homology to any of this. But you look at the relationship among the elements in the system, and it works the same way. Now, you could say these are convergent things that emerge convergently in evolution. But given that just about every living cell has a circadian rhythm, it's not something that's been lost and found and lost and found. I'm not willing to buy that. I think it is the same mechanism. And you can evolve it to go very far from where you started as long as you maintain the relationships among the components. So you now transfer that idea to these networks, and you can and you see the sort of thing that I'm getting at. Well, you can view flies and mammals as being essentially the same. It's the difference is these other species where the sequences are not. Oh, very close. Very, very. Relatively speaking, it's the same molecules doing pretty much the same thing. What's different about it? There's a substitution that you have, instead of timeless being one of the proteins that goes out, associates and comes back, in mammals it's cryptochrome that has now taken that role. That's, relatively speaking, that's a trivial change. Because it's otherwise the same clock mechanism. That's crazy. That's really crazy. And maybe some people argue it, but it's crazy. All right, so let me say it again now. We're talking about a relational system here. So the idea of a relational system is you've got lots and lots of potential connections among elements. And that based on current stimuli, immediate past history of that system, cell, or whatever it is, and its components with which it is endowed genetically, you will get the emergence of a particular set of them at a given time. I'm being just generic here. I'm being generic here about any kind of biological network, where this is a graph theory representation of any network. In biological networks, as I'm sort of trying to run through in my mind, in biological networks, most of the time things are not bidirectional. That tend to jibe with those rest of you who think about these things. No, but most neuronal networks are unidirectional as well. Thank you. Well, it's not a, I wouldn't say that what they're doing is reverse drawing it. They haven't reverse drawn a network from it. What it is a parameter. It gives you parameter to describe what might be different property between two networks. It's not, I don't think it's particular, I don't think it's, for some of the reasons that you're saying, I don't think it's a tool that is going to give you the network. You can't, I don't think you can get it that easily. Anyway, this is my main message, that what we have here is something that is a non-Newtonian system, in a sense. And what gives it this sort of paradoxical flavor is the idea that it's one in which the shape of it changes when you make a manipulation to it. And that's why I don't think you can simply add up your manipulation to try to infer what its actual properties and structure are. You'll get results, as the literature abounds with. And it'll be possible to get results forever, unfortunately, because you actually won't ever come to closure, because every time you do something, you're creating, in a sense, a new situation, which is going to have new properties. That's not going to tell you in the end how the whole thing hangs together. So, these are people who have done this work, you see, and I thank you for your attention.
Okay. Question about, so if I understand this right, you said that fly lines last about 2 months because you've been actively maintaining the system. So if
or at least you start to get new things showing up.
Right, so all of us have fly lines, and we have lines that were, say, 6 months to burn, because we got them 6 months ago, and we all did a behavior, select the one of those behaviors. In theory, we could all have different.
Well, yes, but if your selection was done on a relatively small population, even if four of us started at the same time with the same fly, we could well get different results, as has been the experience in most of the selection literature. The only time people get truly reproducible results in selection experiments is when they use huge populations. So that you're effectively sampling.
Yeah. So for those Kriplinian rhythms you're talking about, you've got basically you've identified it got to be new pathways.
I think they're degenerate pathways.
Right.
One of the things that actually Russ was referring to the other day, which Bambos Kiriakou, my friend and collaborator, reported recently in a meeting, is that when they measured circadian rhythms in flies under totally different conditions and circumstances than are used in the standard lab assays, they actually can find evidence that some of the fly mutants don't have any effect on it, and that there are other genes that seem to be relevant to it. So they do a behavioral change of context and see shifts in what seems to be the relevant underlying mechanism. And your colleague Joel Rothman, who does worm development, is telling me that there's evidence that the patterning in the male tail of the nematode will use different signal transduction pathways depending on the conditions that you grow the worms under. So, and I think that these are just things that people try to minimize those sorts of variations in standard laboratory experiments.
So, like a bot, you could work forever and really not get very far, because what we're saying is for every time that our organism changes with respect to mutations, say the genome that affects any single effect, we could do the whole set of experiments that take years in the field, do it again and again and again under every condition, and identify just more and more and more genes.
That's what I think. I also think that's the reason why the biotechnology industry has been so singularly unsuccessful. Why should it be so unsuccessful unless the underlying assumptions are somehow wrong? And this is why I think they're wrong. It's because you look at a very narrow slice of it, you see what those narrow interactions are, and you extrapolate that. And I think that what you needed instead is to get a more of a conceptual grasp on the way this thing is functioning as a system. And it's not just going to pop out from the data, because when you've got degenerate data, things don't just pop out. Well, nobody wants to hear this.
No, biologists don't want it.
Nobody wants to hear this.
It's not within the realm of molecular biology to solve all.
Well, I presented this in March. Yeah, well, no, people who do systems neurobiology have no problem with this because they've been facing this problem all their lives. I think that there's a biological principle at stake here, a very interesting one, and one that I think will have very wide-ranging application. But you're not going to get it. We're not going to get it unless we try to grapple with it as the problem. That's why I think it's an exciting as opposed to a depressing perspective.
Well, I totally agree with that. Take my observation, you probably going to be correct, but most likely about it's still high. And that's why systems engineering says it's the biology, you haven't caught on at all. Show me a biologist who's using a systems model anyway to use in their work.
Well, it's not necessary for I think that most of the phenotypic changes that I've described don't require that you have the involvement of the entire network. And given the developmental trajectory of the animal and so on, it's very unlikely that you could involve the entire network ever. That's up in the air as to how substantial that would be. Right. So you can get... That's measurable. Yeah, that's measurable. I mean, that's what the expression profiles show you. Okay, gotcha. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and the nature of the connectivities that would be in play and the sort of things that I'm talking about would also be quite varied. That you have the obvious ones, which have been the best studied, are those that have to do with transcriptional hierarchy, where transcription of one gene produces a product that then directly regulates the transcription of another, and so on and so on and so on. But that's by no means the end of the story. You also are going to have protein interaction, which then will have effects back on transcription. You'll also have metabolic effects that are responding to all of this, where the small molecules in turn will have further effects back on transcription and so on. So I mean, these are, you know, there is yet, I mean, one of the things that you can pretty much bet on is that if there's a possible level of regulation in biology among some set of molecules, it's going to be used, whether it's been well defined yet or not. Because pretty much any possible way of regulating things, once people begin to study it, is there. So. I mean, it could, in principle. There are serious problems, as I was telling you earlier today, with trying to do this in these complex multicellular organisms. Because what's the relevant unit of function here is the cell. Because it's the state of the cell where the networks are most sophisticated and relevant. Because the number of interactions between cells, while significant, is a pittance compared to what's going on in the cell. And they're all responding to each other through their own intrinsic networks. So where I would take this next is to do this in unicellular organisms. Mm-hmm. Well, Richard Lenski did that experiment in E. coli. He did 10,000 generation selection experiment of independent lines in the same culture conditions, and they were not identical in the end. In our selection experiments, in all the ones that I described to you, they're not large. It's not a large population at each generation. It's maybe 100 flies at each generation. Okay, yeah. Ken Weber, this guy who did the wing study, has done the best illustration of doing a large population where you get much more reproducible effects. And then he would do, he would assay 10,000 flies at each generation and take the top 1,000. For his next generation, and when he did it at that level, he found that there was much more consistency. Yeah. I'm sorry. I was going for the back. Well, we didn't just look at correlations. We looked at absolute changes in expression and just didn't see it for any of the predictive genes. No, certainly that's a possibility. There may be a simpler explanation for the lack of overlap between them, and that is the nature of the experiment. When you do a mutagenesis, you're looking for, by definition, by the criteria that you use, you're looking for a large effect, single gene change, which will be relatively selective for the phenotype you're interested in. Otherwise, you either don't get it or you throw it away. That's a fairly stringent set of criteria that's going to reduce the number of genes that will ever come through. So anything which would have a very large effect on it, but where a mutation in that component kills the animal, for other reasons, isn't going to come through. Or anything that requires a combination among genes isn't going to come through. Whereas the genes, so what this is telling you, I think, which is relevant for natural selection, is that the substrate that evolution has available to work on is pretty broad, which it would need to be. You basically need to be able to have a lot of potential for how you can begin to shape a phenotype, because otherwise you're going to be dependent on these unbelievably rare events coming along, whatever the hell they do, to give you any kind of ability to have a selective advantage. So if you don't have to depend on that, but instead you can draw on a much wider number of genes which have the characteristics that when you have large effect mutations in them, they are very deleterious for the animal, or they have very widespread effects. So you're not going to be able to confine it to the trait that you're trying to select for. Then that in itself could account for the disparity, because in the selection experiments, that's what you're going to work on. And what I'm doing in my specific gene combination experiments is tapping into that potential, again, by looking at things when they're not knocked out or not severely altered. So I think that there is not ultimately a contradiction between them as long as you can account for how these other more broadly acting genes and combinations can get you to these phenotypic changes. And if we can account for that, then I think we can go a fair distance towards getting a handle on the nature of the system. Oh, it's always a lot. No, with flies, you can't get a single data point without grinding up a large number of them. So we're averaging over a minimum of 50 individuals for every result, for every datum that we can look at. That would have shown up in the correlation analysis that we did. We could pick up negative as well as positive correlation. When I said correlations, I wasn't only referring to ones with a similar sign. We applied it to every gene in the genome, which includes those. We wouldn't have asked that question. So yes, we could. Yes, you could ask that question. That would be a worthwhile question to ask. Individually, they might well be. It's just that it's not always the same ones. All you have to do to make me happy is not insist that they always be the same ones. That's what David and I are going to look at in bacteria. I think that's absolutely true. I think this is utterly relevant to the Venter, for example, attempts to do synthetic cells. That it's not just a matter that what will be critical about the relevant gene repertoire that you put into it is not just which are the critical components, but whether you have enough of a repertoire to be able to have these properties. Because I'm sure that if you don't, you're going to be so fragile and so brittle that you'll only be able to survive in the very, very narrowest slice of conditions. Thank you.